slave labor force, but a strong-arm government that can benefit from the production of narcotics. The agency now set its sights on the fertile growing fields of Afghanistan. War benefits. But the war was not in vain. It had produced a massive new source of cheap labor for global industrialists. The recommended minimum wage for Vietnamese workers was the lowest in the world, amounting to $30 per month in 1994. There was a fortune to be made by relocating American manufacturing plants to the war-ravaged country, which began to produce such American brand-name clothing and shoes as Michael Kors, Dockers, Brooks Brothers, Rockport, and Hanes underwear. Companies such as Microsoft, Nike, Samsung Electronics, LG Group, Intel, Canon, Panasonic, and Toshiba have constructed multi-billion dollar plants in Vietnam thanks to funding from J.P. Morgan Chase of Ho Chi Minh City and Citibank Vietnam. Part 9. The Final Curtain. The real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise their power from behind the scenes. Justice Felix Frankfurter, U.S. Supreme Court. He served from January 30, 1939 to August 28, 1962. I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. Thomas Jefferson, 1802. I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. Woodrow Wilson in 1916, 3 years after signing the Federal Reserve into existence. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Thomas Jefferson. 32. Transforming the population. We Muslims believe that the white race, which is guilty of having oppressed and exploited and enslaved our people here in America, should and will be victims of God's wrath.
Malcolm X, 1964. In 1965, aside from the temples of the Nation of Islam, an African-American religion sect that professed doctrines and beliefs that bore no similarity to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, the only mosques in the United States were in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Dearborn, Michigan, and Washington, D.C., which opened in 1957. And all three boasted fewer than 100 members. Four other cities contained miniature mosques with fewer than 50 members. Small wonder, therefore, that Islam in America failed to merit the attention of religious demographers, such as Leo Rosten and Will Herberg, let alone a line of ink in the two volumes of Sidney E. Ahlstrom's A Religious History of the American People, which appeared in 1972. The absence of Muslims from the millions of immigrants was due to the restrictive immigration legislation that remained in effect to safeguard the racial and religious balance of America. The Naturalization Act of 1790 stipulated that any alien being a free white person may be admitted to become a citizen of the United States. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 prohibited Chinese families from immigrating to the United States. With their strange language, customs, and dress, the Chinese were considered incapable of assimilation. The ban on the Chinese would persist until Chiang Kai-shek became a U.S. ally during World War II. The Immigration Act of 1891 reorganized the states bordering Mexico, Arizona, New Mexico, and a large part of Texas, into the Mexican Border District to stem the flow of immigrants into the United States. This act also contained a list of undesirables who should be prevented from entering the country. The list included, in an apparent reference to Islam, polygamists, along with diseased persons, convicts, paupers, idiots, and the insane. The Immigration Acts of 1903 and 1907 expanded the category of undesirables to include political radicals, people with physical and mental defects, and children unaccompanied by their parents. The quota system. By 1924, the U.S. Congress closed the floodgates to the country and limited the annual flow of immigrants into the country to 2% of each nationality who lived in the country in 1890. The reliance of this legislation on the ethnic composition of the country before the turn of the century guaranteed that the majority of new arrivals would be from Northern Europe. Since few Italians and Eastern Europeans lived in the United States in 1890, the quotas for these nationalities became fixed at marginal rates, and the number of new immigrants from undesirable regions was greatly reduced. The following chart shows the effects of this legislation. Immigration Statistics 1920 to 1926. Year, 1920. The total entering the U.S., 430,001. The country of origin, from Great Britain, 38,471. From Eastern Europe, 3,913. From Italy, 95,145. 1921, 805,228 entering the U.S., 51,142 from Great Britain, 32,793 from Eastern Europe, 222,260 from Italy. 1922, 309,556 total entering. Of that, 25,153 from Great Britain, 12,244 from Eastern Europe, 40,319 from Italy. 1923, 522,919 total. Of that, 45,759 from Great Britain, 16,082 from Eastern Europe, 46,674 from Italy. 1924, 706,896 total entered. Of that, 59,490 from Great Britain, 13,173 from Eastern Europe, 56,246 from Italy. 1925, 294,314 total entering. Of that, 27,172 from Great Britain, 1,566 from Eastern Europe, 6,203 from Italy. 1926, 304,488 total entering. Of that, 25,528 from Great Britain, 1,596 from Eastern Europe, 8,253 from Italy. As a result of the 1924 Act, immigration fell sharply. By the 1930s, it declined to 50,000 a year. During World War II, it was halted, though 400,000 displaced persons were brought to the United States following the war. The quotas upheld. In 1952, the McCarran-Walter Immigration Act affirmed the national origins quota system of 1924 and limited total annual immigration to 1/6 of 1% of the population of the continental United States in 1920, or 175,455. The act exempted spouses and children of U.S. citizens and people born in the Western Hemisphere from the quota. the new legislation angered President Harry Truman, whose veto had been overridden by both houses of Congress.
The idea behind the discriminatory policy was, to put it boldly, that Americans with English or Irish names were better people and better citizens than Americans with Italian or Greek or Polish names. Such a concept is utterly unworthy of our traditions and our ideals.
Senator Pat McCarran, however, defended the legitimacy of the legislation, which he had co-authored, by saying,
"I believe that this nation is the last hope of Western civilization. And if this oasis of the world shall be overrun, perverted, contaminated, or destroyed, then the last flickering light of humanity will be extinguished. I take no issue with those who would praise the contributions which have been made to our society by people of many races, of varied creeds and colors. America is indeed a joining together of many streams which go to form a mighty river, which we call the American Way. However, we have in the United States today hardcore, indigestible blocks which have not become integrated into the American way of life, but which, on the contrary, are its deadly enemies. Today, as never before, untold millions are storming our gates for admission, and those gates are cracking under the strain. The solution of the problems of Europe and Asia will not come through a transplanting of those problems en masse to the United States. I do not intend to become prophetic, but if the enemies of this legislation succeed in riddling it to pieces or in amending it beyond recognition, they will have contributed more to promote this nation's downfall than any other group since we achieved our independence as a nation."
Seal of inferiority. The push for immigration reform came from two sources. The first was a group that consisted of influential Jewish congressmen and senators, including Emanuel Seller, Jacob Javits, and Herbert H. Lehman, whose efforts to eliminate the quota system were backed by such powerful Jewish organizations as the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Committee, the National Council of Jewish Women, the Hebrew Aid Society, the Synagogue Council of America, B'nai B'rith, the Jewish Labor Committee, and the Jewish War Veterans of the United States. The quota system, these legislators and activists believed, smacked of anti-Semitism, and in the words of Dr. Israel Goldstein, president of the American Jewish Committee, placed a legislative seal of inferiority on all persons of other than Anglo-Saxon origin. The Hart-Celler Bill was designed to level the playing field for future generations of European Jews. It had been penned by Norbert Schley, a prominent Jewish-American lawyer in the Johnson administration who had also authored the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Funded by the money cartel. A second source of the legislation was the thought of Count Richard Nicholas von Kudenhove-Kalergi, the son of an Austrian diplomat and Japanese heiress, who had been hailed as the father of the European Union. Upon receiving his doctorate from the University of Vienna in 1917, Kudenhove-Kalergi became an advocate for Woodrow Wilson's 14 points and the Pacific initiatives of Carl Hiller. In 1921, he joined the Masonic Lodge Humanitas, which he used as the launching pad for his Pan-Europa movement. 1 year later, he published the Pan-Europa Manifesto, which captured the attention of Baron Louis de Rothschild and Max Warburg, father of Paul, the founder of the Federal Reserve, who opted to fund the movement to unify Europe with 60,000 gold marks. In his books Praktischer Idealismus and Kampf in Paneuropa, Kudenhove-Kalergi argued for the dissolution of national borders and the promotion of mass allogenic, genetically dissimilar immigration. The result of this immigration, Kudenhove-Kalergi wrote, would be the creation of the men of future, whom he called mestizos. Such men would be of mixed Caucasian, Negro, and Asiatic blood, and would appear very similar to the ancient Egyptians. The mongrelization of mankind, according to Kudenhove-Kalergi,
would produce salubrious results, such as the dissolution of nationalism, the elimination of racism, and the eradication of disparities in levels of human intelligence. Since the mestizos would be of limited intelligence, Coudenhove-Kalergi maintained they could be easily manipulated and controlled by Jewish leaders of socialism, Herren Menschen, who had been singled out by divine providence to rule the world. Although he was neither a Jew nor of Jewish descent, Coudenhove-Kalergi wrote,
2,000 years ago, the ancient Christians, not the Pharisees and Sadducees, were the revivers of the Mosaic tradition. Today, it is neither the Zionists nor the Christians, but the Jewish leaders of socialism, because they wish, with their most exalted unselfishness, to erase the original sin of capitalism, to free people from injustice, violence, and subservience, and to change the redeemed world into an earthly paradise.
Protected by the CFR. Coudenhove-Kalergi's scheme to initiate the onset of world socialism by open borders and mass migration was derailed by the rise of fascism. His works were relegated to the bonfire by the Nazis, and he was forced to flee to France. When France fell to Hitler's forces in 1940, Coudenhove-Kalergi made his way to the United States, where he came under the care of the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. As an advisor to the group, he helped to draft the wartime strategy of the Office of Strategic Services and the post-war plans for the revitalization of Europe. By 1949, his list of disciples included Senator William Fulbright, William J. Donovan, Alan Dulles, Thomas W. Braden, Arthur Goldberg, J. Lovestone, and Joseph H. Rettinger, who worked together to create the American Committee for a United Europe. This organization gave rise to the European Coal and Steel Community, the predecessor to the European Union. In 1950, Coudenhove-Kalergi, who had called for the elimination of the Caucasian race for the sake of a superstate, received the first annual Karlspreis, Charlemagne Award, for his contribution to European ideals. Throughout the next 77 years, the winners of the coveted award would be ardent philo-Semites and enthusiastic supporters of multiculturalism. The list of recipients included the names of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, General George Marshall, U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, French President François Mitterrand, former Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, U.S. President Bill Clinton, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and Pope Francis I. The ideas of the celebrated Austrian Count gave rise not only to a unified Europe, but also to the belief that the white race of Americans must be eradicated for the good of humanity. Susan Sontag, one of Coudenhove-Kalergi's admirers, penned these words in 1967 for Partisan Review.
If America is the culmination of Western white civilization, as everyone from the left to the right declares, then there must be something terribly wrong with Western white civilization. This is a painful truth. Few of us want to go that far. The truth is that Mozart, Pascal, Boolean algebra, Shakespeare, parliamentary government, Baroque churches, Newton, the emancipation of women, Kant, Marx, Balanchine, Ballets, et al., don't redeem what this particular civilization has wrought upon the world. The white race is the cancer of human history. It is the white race, and it alone, its ideologies and inventions, which eradicates autonomous civilizations wherever it spreads, which has upset the ecological balance of the planet, which now threatens the very existence of life itself.
A simple symbolic act. The Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965 was supposed to serve as a symbolic gesture, an extension of civil rights sentiments that would not produce a huge and sustained increase in the number of newcomers from third world countries, let alone serve as a vehicle for globalizing immigration. Senate Immigration Subcommittee Chairman and prominent CFR member Edward Kennedy, Democrat, Massachusetts,
who served to shepherd the bill through the Senate, offered this reassurance to his fellow legislators.
First, our cities will not be flooded with 1 million immigrants annually. Under the proposed bill, the present level of immigration remains substantially the same. Secondly, the ethnic mix of this country will not be upset. Contrary to the charges in some quarters, the bill will not inundate America with immigrants from any one country or area, or the most populated and deprived nations of Africa and Asia. In the final analysis, the ethnic pattern of immigration under the proposed measure is not expected to change as sharply as the critics seem to think. The bill will not flood our cities with immigrants. It will not upset the ethnic mix of our society. It will not relax the standards of admission. It will not cause American workers to lose their jobs.
Echoing this claim, the new Attorney General, Nicholas Katzenbach, a Rhodes Scholar and future CFR director, testified,
"This bill is not designed to increase or accelerate the numbers of newcomers permitted to come to America. Indeed, this measure provides for an increase of only a small fraction in permissible immigration."
The warnings ignored. Opponents of the bill, most of them conservatives, still in disarray from the rout of Barry Goldwater in the 1964 presidential campaign, argued that the Hart-Celler bill would vastly increase the number of immigrants coming into the country, and that the bulk of those immigrants would be coming from third world nations, representing a threat to the country's existing demographic profile. Myra C. Hacker, vice president of the New Jersey Coalition of Patriotic Societies, warned of granting entree to an indeterminately enormous number of aliens from underprivileged lands. Whatever may be America's benevolent intent toward many people, Ms. Hacker maintained, the bill fails to give due consideration to the economic needs, the cultural traditions, and the public sentiment of the citizens of the United States. She also said that the proposed legislation had hidden mathematics about which the public was not being informed. In the Senate, another opponent, Sam Ervin, Democrat, North Carolina, said that it was impossible not to discriminate, and that it was therefore all right to favor groups who historically had the greatest influence in building the nation. To put all the Earth's peoples on the same basis as prospective immigrants to the United States, Ervin argued, was to discriminate against the people who had first settled and shaped the country. Ervin found an ally in Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat, West Virginia, who said the current 1965 system was just and wise, since additional population from Western European countries was more easily and readily assimilated into the American population. Byrd added, "Why should the United States be the only advanced nation in the world today to develop a guilt complex concerning its immigration policies?" The House of Representatives voted 326-69, 82.5%, in favor of the act, while the Senate passed the bill by a vote of 76-18. The floodgates to the New World finally had been pried open. Only Malcolm X had foreseen the enormous ramifications of this change in legislation, for he had written,
"As the Christian crusade once went east, now the Islamic crusade is going west. With the East, Asia, closed to Christianity, with Africa rapidly becoming converted to Islam, with Europe rapidly becoming un-Christian. Generally today it is accepted that the Christian civilization of white America, which is propping up the white race around the world, is Christianity's remaining strongest bastion. Well, if this is so, if the so-called Christianity now being practiced in America displays the best that the world Christianity has to offer, no one in his right mind should need any much greater proof that very close at hand is the end of Christianity. Are you aware that some Protestant theologians in their writings are using the phrase post-Christian era? And they mean now."
Population control. The Rockefeller family, throughout the decades, remained fixated on other aspects of population redistribution and control, including matters of people planning. On July 18, 1969, President Richard M. Nixon appointed John D. Rockefeller III as chairman of the newly created Commission on Population Growth and the American Future. Accepting this appointment, John D. III said, "The average citizen doesn't appreciate the social and economic implications of population growth and what it does to the quality of all our lives. Rather than think of population control as a negative thing, we should see it as enriching." One of the first reports from the commission recommended that present state laws restricting abortion be liberalized along the lines of New York State statute, that such abortions be performed on request by duly licensed physicians under conditions of medical safety. The commission further suggested that federal, state, and local governments make funds available to support abortion services. Thanks to this report, the New York Model Abortion Law, which the commission enthusiastically endorsed, was passed in 1970 under the leadership of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, John D. III's brother. This legislation, coupled with statements from the commission, paved the way for Roe v. Wade. In the summer of 1971, Planned Parenthood of New York City, with the financial support of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, set up the country's first large-scale abortion mill. It was designed to perform 10,000 abortions a year for an average fee of $80, which was provided by Medicaid. The prototype had been set. By 1976, America's second centennial, more unborn babies had been put to death in the country's abortion mills than the total number of American soldiers who had been killed in combat from the Battle of Lexington in 1776 to the last fatality in Vietnam. By 2017, 59,115,995 babies had been aborted in a land once consecrated to Christian ideals. 33. Only the Dead Know Brooklyn and Other Stories.
In the context of the modern world, and considering the various crises which the Muslim world is encountered with due to highly publicized crusade against Islam in the name of war against terrorism, it appears that America is the most suitable place where Islam can shower its infinite blessings on its people in due course. Where American leadership is very much scared of Islam's inherent magnetic power that is attracting people who are in search of truth and a system of life that can resolve the problems of both the worlds. The causes of this hopeful situation, the reasons for this upbeat approach, and the possibilities of its occurrence are various and very convincing. It is in the nature of Islam that the more it is tried to be crushed through opposition, suppression, and oppression, the more it rebounds and resurrects with great thud. The history of revival of Islam in modern Russia after the collapse of communism and that of recent Turkey are the glaring examples of this reality. Thus, America, due to its predominant anti-Islam policies both at home and abroad, has become the most natural place for its revival as a geopolitical entity. In fact, Allah has perhaps selected this land out of His infinite mercy to be the future home of Islam.
Shamim Sadiqi, Islam, the Future of America, 2005. By 2017, Islam had permeated nearly every aspect of American life. But the full extent of the permeation remained the X factor. But this much came to light. In 1990, fewer than 600 mosques existed in the United States. By 2012, that number climbed to 2,106. Nearly 8.5% of America's 330,000 houses of worship were now mosques. A 2008 study by Cornell University projected that the number of Muslims in America had climbed from 1.6 million in 1995 to 7 million. A U.S. News and World Report survey, which was conducted at the same time, placed the figure at 5 million. The real number remained anyone's guess, since the U.S. Census Bureau neglected to collect data on religious identification. In 2016, the Pew Research Center projected the Islamic population of the United States to be 3.3 million. But Pew researchers admit that their survey was not thorough, since it neglected to take into account immigrant and poor black Muslims. What's more, researchers only contacted Americans with telephone landlines. They failed to take into account the fact that nearly 50% of U.S. residents, people ages 18 to 35, and nearly 100% of illegal immigrants communicate exclusively by cell phones. Muslim organizations, such as the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CAIR, supported the Cornell University projection of 7 million, based on mosque attendance. The White House and the U.S. State Department uphold this figure. The Islamic boom was evidenced by reports of the new mosques and halal restaurants that had sprouted up within every major American city. By 2010, according to one report, Washington, D.C. boasted 7 mosques and 134 halal restaurants. San Francisco, 24 mosques and 176 halal restaurants. Houston, 15 and 50, respectively. Chicago, 27 and 61, respectively. Cleveland, 15 and 11, respectively. Boston, 19 and 60, respectively. Knoxville, 32 and 6, respectively. St. Louis, 21 and 8, respectively. Lansing, 27 and 6, respectively. Toledo, 17 and 5, respectively. Buffalo, 9 and 11, respectively. Dallas, 21 and 13, respectively. Grand Rapids, 19 and 7, respectively. New Orleans, 6 and 3, respectively. Nashville, 11 and 10, respectively. Columbia, 12 and 2, respectively. Detroit, 3 and 89, respectively. Atlanta, 9 and 22, respectively. Peoria, 5 and 1, respectively. Lincoln, 25 and 2, respectively. And Shreveport, Louisiana, 21 and 1, respectively. There are 14 new mosques in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and 25 in Anchorage, Alaska. Many of the Islamic houses of worship were massive structures, which attracted thousands of believers to Friday afternoon prayer service, Jumu'ah. These large mosques included the Islamic Center of America, Dearborn, Michigan, the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C., the Adams Center in Sterling, Virginia, the Al-Farouk Masjid in Atlanta, the Islamic Society of New York, Dar al-Hijra in Falls Church, Virginia, the Tucson Islamic Center, and the King Fahd Mosque in Los Angeles. Even the smallest mosques, including the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Falls, Iowa, could easily contain several hundred members and visitors for a single service. Much of the funding for the new mosques came from the wealthy Saudi princes, who sought to further the Islamic transformation of America. By 2010, the median mosque in America drew a crowd of 300 worshippers to its Friday service, while the average Christian church mustered a meager Sunday gathering of 75. The transformed landscape. To come to terms with the social, political, economic, and religious impact of Islam on the U.S. landscape, you need only pay a visit to Brooklyn, the borough of New York City once known as the All-American Neighborhood. Such a visit will make you aware not only of the Islamic transformation of U.S. cities, but also of the woeful inadequacies of religious statistics, especially those that pertain to mosques and the number of Muslims now residing within major metropolitan areas throughout the country. Brooklyn conjures up magical images in the American imagination: Brooklyn Bridge, Coney Island, Fulton's Ferry, brownstone townhouses, and the Dodgers. It was home to William Boss Tweed, Currier and Ives, Margaret Sanger, Louis Tiffany, Al Capone, Gil Hodges, Pee Wee Reese, Leonard Bernstein, Barbara Streisand, and Ralph and Alice Cramden of the Honeymooners. Brooklyn gave birth to hot dogs, roller coasters, soda pop, and more breweries than any other city in the country. One out of every seven Americans can trace their family roots to the streets of this borough. Yet Brooklyn is no longer quintessentially American. The breweries are closed, Ebbets Field remains a memory, and the hot dog stands have disappeared. Gone, too, are the Navy Yard that built such legendary warships as the Monitor, the Arizona, and the New Mexico, and the Daily Eagle, where Walt Whitman once toiled as an editor. They have vanished, along with the Jewish delis, the Irish bars, and the nightclubs that had been made famous by John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. Brooklyn is a city that is changing into a place that is antithetical to American sensibilities. It has become a thriving haven of Islam. Returning to Brooklyn after a hiatus of 20 years, Sarah Honig of the Jerusalem Post was shocked by the changes that had occurred in her old neighborhood. "When I climbed up the grimy station stairs and surveyed the street, I suspected that some supernatural time and space warp had transported me to Islamabad. This couldn't be Brooklyn. Women strode attired in hijabs, and male passers-by sported all manner of Muslim headgear and long flowing tunics. Pakistani and Bangladeshi groceries lined the main shopping drag, and everywhere stickers boldly beckoned, "Discover Jesus in the Quran." Throughout Brooklyn, one can now hear the call of the muezzin 5 times a day from rooftop speakers.
"Allahu Akbar, ashhadu an la ilaha illallah."
Cab drivers pull their hacks to the side of the road and perform ritual ablutions. Shopkeepers roll out their prayer rugs toward the holy city. And life within the borough, which was once known as the City of Churches, comes to a standstill. The massive migration of Muslims to this borough of New York, coupled with the widespread conversion of African Americans throughout Bedford-Stuyvesant and other Brooklyn neighborhoods to Islam, has been hailed as a salubrious development by many Brooklynites. The Muslim newcomers have been credited by Brooklyn Mayor Marty Markowitz with closing crack houses and driving drug dealers from the crime-infested streets. "I see more and more Muslims taking part in social life. The future is looking good," Markowitz says. Eric Bullen recalls that his store, Al's Men's Shop at 1140 Fulton, was one of the few functioning businesses on what had become a block of vacant storefronts. "It used to be so bad at times that people didn't want to even be seen out here too late. You could guarantee that had they come through once it started to get dark, they were going to get mugged," he recalls. The Muslims, he said, were instrumental in changing things. Community Affairs Officer Stephen Ruffin says that the imams of Brooklyn mosques, including Masjid al-Taqwa, have established unprecedented community cooperation with the police by creating civil patrols to police many of the borough's trouble spots. Enemy territory. Yet others view the Islamic transformation of the borough as something threatening and sinister. Many Jews and Christians throughout Brooklyn now display American flags and an assortment of patriotic, jingoistic banners in their front yards. These displays, for the most part, are acts of defiance. "We're besieged," one resident told the Jerusalem Post. "Making a statement is all we can do. They aren't delighted to see the flag wave. This is enemy territory." Even Markowitz and others supportive of the newcomers reluctantly note that the vast majority of Muslim newcomers display an unwillingness to assimilate. They continue to wear Islamic attire, maintain halal diets, and rigidly comply with Sharia law. Most equate Americanism with hedonism. They shun fast food restaurants, any food containing alcohol, including chocolate, and American cars. Few Muslim women walk the streets without a head covering. Some wear full burqas that conceal their bodies and niqabs that conceal their faces, leaving only mesh-covered slits for their eyes. The assimilation process in Brooklyn appears to be working in reverse, since the new male converts to Islam, almost all of whom are African-American, now wear skull caps and long white tunics, shalwat, kameezes, while their wives walk several feet behind them in black burqas or abaya gowns. They dye their beards with henna, refrain from eating pork and drinking alcoholic beverages, and greet each other in Arabic, As-salamu, alaikum. Polygamy, among the newcomers and converts, is commonplace, and khat, the favorite narcotic of North African Muslims, is now cut up and sold on street corners, halal grocery shops, and places like the Blue Province Restaurant. In crowded flats and makeshift clinics along Atlantic Avenue, young Muslim girls, some as young as 2, are subjected to the practice of female genital mutilation. Dubbed female circumcision, this practice consists of the removal of the clitoris, without the benefit of anesthesia or surgical instruments. Broken bottles or tin can lids occasionally serve as scalpels. Recent statistics show that 41,000 Somali and other North African Muslims in Brooklyn and the other boroughs of New York City have been subjugated to this ordeal. While the overwhelming majority of Muslims in Brooklyn remain purportedly moderate in belief, at least 7% are extremely radical and support violent attacks against all non-believers, including the attacks of 9/11. By 1989, the first North American cell of Al-Kifa, an organization that would eventually morph into Al-Qaeda, was implanted by Abdullah Azam within Brooklyn's Masjid Al-Farouk at 554 Atlantic Avenue, a 6-story converted factory trimmed in orange and gold. Members of this mosque came to play key roles in the assassination of Rabbi Meir Kahana, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, and the planning of 9/11. By 2002, they managed to raise over $20 million for bin Laden and millions more for other terrorist groups. The mosque served as an arsenal, stocked with rifles, shotguns, 9mm and 357 caliber handguns, and AK-47 assault weapons. Yet the mosque remains off-limits to law enforcement officials, since it is registered as a house of worship. Brooklyn also gave birth to Dar-ul-Islam, the nation's most notorious Islamic street gang. Jamaat-ul-Fukra, a Muslim group that had been responsible for 30 terror attacks on American soil, and the Albanian Mafia, which became the country's leading crime outfit. What has taken place in Brooklyn has occurred in major cities throughout the country, most notably Detroit, Washington, D.C., Cedar Rapids, Philadelphia, and Atlanta, and even quaint towns and villages such as Lodi, California, Lewiston, Maine, Hancock, New York, Commerce, Georgia, and Hamtramck, Michigan. 34. The New Network.
What is important to the history of the world? The Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred-up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War?
Zbigniew Brzezinski, 1998. With the fall of Saigon, the CIA set its sights on the Golden Crescent, where the highlands of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran all converge, for a new source of drug revenue. Since the 17th century, opium poppies were grown in this region by local tribesmen, and the market remained regional. By the 1950s, very little opium was produced in Afghanistan and Pakistan, with about 2,500 acres in both countries under cultivation. At the close of the Vietnam War, the fertile growing fields of Afghanistan's Helmand Valley were covered with vineyards, wheat, and cotton. The major problem for the CIA was the Afghan government of Nur Muhammad Taraki, who sought to eradicate poppy production in the border regions of the country that remained occupied by radical Islamic fundamentalists. This attempt at eradication sprang from Taraki's desire to unite all the Pashtun tribes under the Kabul rule. The fundamentalists spurned such efforts not only because of their desire to keep the cash crops, but also because they viewed the Taraki government as shirk, blasphemy. The modernist regime advocated female education and prohibited arranged marriages and the bride price. By 1975, the tension between government and the fundamentalists erupted into violence when Pashtun tribesmen mounted a revolt in the Panjshir Valley north of Kabul. The tribesmen were led by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who became the new darling of the CIA. The Muslim Madman. Hekmatyar made his public debut in 1972 at the University of Kabul by killing a leftist student. He fled to Pakistan, where he became an agent of Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, and the leader of Hezb-e-Islami, an organization dedicated to the formation of a pure Islamic state ruled by the most intransigent interpretation of Sunni law. Hekmatyar urged his followers to throw acid in the faces of women not wearing a veil, kidnapped rival Islamic chieftains, and in 1977 began to build up an arsenal, courtesy of the CIA. The agency also began to funnel millions to the ISI, which became transformed into its surrogate on the Afghan border. The CIA believed that Hekmatyar, despite the fact that he was clearly unhinged, would be of inestimable value not only in undermining the Taraki government, but also in gaining control of the poppy fields in the Helmand Valley. Its faith was not misplaced. Throughout 1978, a year before the Soviet invasion, Hekmatyar and his Mujahideen, holy warriors, burned universities and girls' schools throughout Afghanistan and gained feudal control over many of the poppy farmers. The pro-Taraki militants, aware of the destabilization plot, assassinated Adolf Spike Dubs, the U.S. ambassador to Kabul, on February 14, 1979. Thanks to Hekmatyar's actions, heroin production rose from 400 tons in 1971 to 1,200 tons in 1978. After the assassination of Dubs and the flow of millions to Hekmatyar's guerrilla army, the production soared to 1,800 tons and a network of laboratories was set up by the Mujahideen along the Afghan-Pakistan border. The morphine base was transported by caravans of trucks from the Helmand Valley through northern Iran to the Anatolian plains of Turkey. The Holy War. In the summer of 1979, 6 months before the Soviet invasion, the U.S. State Department issued a memorandum making clear its stake in the Mujahideen.
The United States' larger interest would be served by the demise of the Taraki regime, despite whatever setbacks this might mean for future social and economic reform in Afghanistan. The overthrow of the DRA, Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, would show the rest of the world, particularly the Third World, that the Soviets' view of the socialist course of history as being inevitable is not accurate.
In September 1979, Taraki was killed in a coup organized by Afghan military officers. Hafizullah Amin became installed as the country's new president. Amin had impeccable Western credentials. He had been educated at Columbia University and the University of Wisconsin. He had served as the president of the Afghan Students Association, which had been funded by the Asia Foundation, a CIA front. After the coup, he met regularly with U.S. embassy officials, while the CIA continued to fund Hekmatyar's rebels in Pakistan. Fearing a fundamentalist, U.S.-backed regime at its border, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan on December 27, 1979. The CIA got what it wanted. The Holy War had begun. For the next decade, black aid, amounting to more than $3 billion, would be poured into Afghanistan to support the Holy Warriors, making it the most expensive covert operation in U.S. history. Such vast expenditures demanded an exponential increase in poppy production, which Hekmatyar and his fellow jihadists were pleased to provide. Afghanistan delight. The war in Afghanistan delighted State Department officials, including Secretary of State Zbigniew Brzezinski, voicing the utopian vision of what author Chalmers Johnson called the military-industrial complex. Brzezinski wrote of the plans to control Eurasia, including Turkey, Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
"For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia. Now a non-Eurasian power is preeminent in Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. To put it in terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires,
The three great imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together.
Brzezinski and fellow members of his overworld realized that the concept of democracy and freedom could never galvanize the scattered tribes and peoples of Central Asia. The people could only be unified by the cause of Allah, since they were overwhelmingly Islamic. The holy war in Afghanistan, in the view of the U.S. geostrategists, offered many benefits, including the possible downfall of the Soviet Union and the possibility of gaining access and control over the vast natural gas and oil resources of Eurasia. Months before the Soviet invasion in 1979, the CIA launched Operation Cyclone, an attempt to destabilize the Soviet Union by spreading militant Islam throughout the Central Asian republics. Eventually, this operation would serve to create hundreds of Islamic terror organizations, including Al-Qaeda, Al-Jihad, the Ulema Union of Afghanistan, the Salafi Group for Proselytism and Combat, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, Al-Bada, Harakat ul-Ansar, Jamiat Ulema-i-Islam, Jamiat ul-Ulema-i-Pakistan, Lashkar-i-Taiba, and the Al-Jihad Group. It would also give rise to terror attacks that would kill and maim millions of people throughout the world, and the dream espoused by Fethullah Gulen and his disciples of a new Islamic world order. The BCCI.
In 1972, the Bank of Credit and Commerce, BCCI, was set up in Karachi by Aga Hassan Avedi, a financier who had deep connections to Pakistan's underworld, the Turkish Babas and oil-rich sheikhs of Abu Dhabi. It represented the ideal spot for the CIA to set up a laundry within the Golden Crescent. Thanks to the agency, the BCCI became registered in Luxembourg and soon mushroomed into a vast criminal enterprise with 400 branches in 78 countries, including First American Bank in Washington, D.C., the National Bank of Georgia, and the Independence Bank of Encino, California. Virtually free from scrutiny, it engaged not only in money laundering the heroin proceeds, but also arms trafficking on a grand scale, including the sale of French-made jet fighters to Chile and Chinese silkworm missiles to Saudi Arabia. By 1985, it became the seventh largest financial institution in the world, handling the money for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega, Palestinian terrorist Abur Nidal, Al-Qaeda chieftain Osama bin Laden, Liberian President Samuel Doe, and leading members of the Medellin cartel. Prominent spooks, including CIA Director William Casey, made regular visits to the BCCI's headquarters in Karachi, making the Pakistani city the new haven for covert operations. The bank served the agency in a myriad of ways by paying bribes, providing young beauties from Lahore, and funneling cash for assassins. The enormity of the bank's operations was evidenced by its transfer of $4 billion in covert aid to Iraq from 1985 to 1989. For the Iraqi transfer, the BCCI made use of the Atlanta branch of Banca Nazionale del Lavoro, BNL, an Italian bank with ties to the IOR. Henry Kissinger sat on BNL's International Advisory Board along with Brent Scowcroft, who became President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor. John R. Bath, an alleged CIA operative, became one of BCCI's directors. While serving the Pakistani bank, Bath was the co-owner with future President George W. Bush of Arbusto Energy, a Texas oil company. Sheikh Abdullah Bakhsh, a fellow BCCI official, served, according to the Kerry Commission, as the principal liaison for the CIA in the entire Middle East from the mid-1960s through 1979.
Phony audits. Although a cursory investigation would have uncovered the bank's engagement in issuing phony loans, making phantom deposits, and publishing false financial reports, Price Waterhouse, the prestigious London accounting firm, published annual statements giving BCCI its unqualified approval. The Kerry Commission later concluded that the Price Waterhouse accountants failed to protect BCCI's innocent depositors and creditors from the consequences of poor practices at the bank of which the auditors were aware for years. In 1991, the BCCI, like so many other CIA banks, went bust, leaving a financial hole of $13 billion. Creditors subsequently brought action against Price Waterhouse, claiming damages because of the firm's accounting negligence in excess of $11 billion. The matter was eventually settled out of court. Ironically, in the wake of this settlement, the Vatican turned to Price Waterhouse to certify its balance sheets, a choice that journalist David Yalop characterized as bizarre. The CIA's complicity. In its opening statement regarding the CIA's relationship to BCCI, the Kerry Commission maintained, "The relationships involving BCCI, the CIA, and members of the United States and foreign intelligence communities have been among the most perplexing aspects of understanding the rise and fall of BCCI. The CIA's and BCCI's mutual environments of secrecy have been one obvious obstacle. For many months, the CIA resisted providing information to the subcommittee about its involvement with and knowledge of BCCI. Moreover, key players who might explain these relationships are unavailable. Some, including former CIA Director William Casey and BCCI customers and Iranian arms dealers Ben Banerjee and Cyrus Hashemi, are dead. Others, including most of BCCI's key insiders, remain held incommunicado in Abu Dhabi. While promising in public hearings to provide full cooperation to the subcommittee, to date, the Abu Dhabi government has refused to make any BCCI officers available for interview by the subcommittee. Former BCCI Chairman Aga Hassan Abedi remains severely incapacitated due to a heart attack. Finally, some persons in a position to know portions of the truth have denied having any memory of events in which they participated and of documents which they reviewed." Drug boom. The Golden Triangle was now producing 80% of the world's opium supply. At the end of 1982, the DEA had evidence of over 40 heroin syndicates and 200 heroin laboratories operating in Pakistan. The CIA deposited a large share of its profits from these operations in the Shakarchi Trading Company in Lebanon, which served not only as a convenient laundry, but also as a shipping firm that delivered 8.5-ton shipments of choice brown product to the Gambino crime syndicate in New York. In keeping with the policy of false flags, the sharp rise in heroin production was blamed on the Soviet generals in Kabul. "The regime maintains an absolute indifference to any measures to control poppy," Edwin Meese, President Reagan's attorney general, said during a visit to Islamabad. "We strongly believe that there is actually encouragement, at least tacitly, over growing poppy." The increased flow of heroin affected all regions of the world, including Pakistan. Before the CIA program, there were fewer than 5,000 heroin users in Pakistan. At the end of the Soviet-Afghanistan War, there were 1.6 million heroin addicts. Arkansas Narco Bank. But the principal laundry for the new heroin network remained the BCCI, which continued to retain its primary offices in London and Karachi. James R. Bath, a CIA associate and the business partner of George W. Bush, remained a primary director. Bert Lance, an American businessman who served as the director of the Office of Management and Budget under President Carter, emerged in 1981 as a key BCCI consultant, along with Arkansas-based power broker Jackson Stevens. In accordance with the wishes of William Casey, the CIA director under President Reagan, the BCCI stood alone, financially independent, and free from congressional scrutiny.
Thanks to Lance and Stevens, Western Arkansas suddenly became a hub of international drug smuggling. Cocaine was being smuggled into the small airport in Mena by CIA assets, including pilot Barry Seal. These assets also transported to Mena huge bales of cash, which was laundered by BCCI's First American Bank. First American